For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Tonight we're going to get on past Exodus 20 and get into 21, 22, 23. And we're going to be talking about something called case law. It's different than the principalized law, these broad ethical concepts you see in the Ten Commandments. This is a specific type of laws that are used to run the society. Got to remember, the Pentateuch was not just a revelation for individuals. It was also the national constitution of an ancient nation, of Israel. And so they had courts and laws that had to be enforced in various ways. And now these case laws are used in the courts. These are actually provided to judges as a template or a pattern. You know, if this happens, do that. But if that happens, do the other thing. And so they're not likely to run into exactly that case, but their other case would be analogous. It'd be close enough that they can basically see how to reason their way through it. And it shows, kind of shows them what direction to take, you know, with their rulings. So it's quite different than the kind of stuff we've been studying, which is broadly applicable ethical principles that apply to all people in all situations. These are very narrow, very different. We need to dig into that, though. It's an interesting area. Yeah, like I said, anti-biblical apologists really zero in on this case law business as a premium target for attacks, and argue that the Bible is immoral, and any God that supposedly inspired this would himself be immoral. Here's a few examples. Let's dive right into verse 1. These are the regulations you must present to Israel. If you buy a Hebrew servant, he may serve you for no more than 6 years. Then set him free in the seventh year. He'll owe you nothing for his freedom. Slavery. I've substituted the word servant with what many versions translate slave. And the reason for that is because our understanding of slavery in modern America is based on, you know, pre-Civil War Southern race slavery, which was quite different than ancient Israel. Well, you can see it's different already. The maximum term a slave or servant could serve was 6 years. Then they had to be turned loose. Well, also, I think it should be called servant because we'll find out that these were not involuntarily put into service, but would give themselves. They would sign a contract, basically, promising to serve. It's more like what we call indentured servitude, something that used to be more common, was common in the U.S., not just in the South, but in the North. A lot of Europeans that came over in the early days and colonial days of America, according to Dr. Copan's, 2/3 of the immigrants coming to the United States couldn't afford to buy passage on a ship. And so they would find a wealthier person and promise to work for them for X number of years in exchange for their passage on the ship to get over here. So in New England, you know, tons of people, and it wasn't a race-based thing or anything like that. It was just, you know, it was poor people buying their way over here by a certain number of years of service. In chapter 21:16, we see a law: kidnappers must be put to death, whether they're caught in possession of their victims or have already sold them as slaves. So anyone that went out trying to capture people to enslave them, that's a capital crime in Israel. So that right there you see that these are not, it's nothing like what was going on where they would capture people in Africa and bring them as slaves to the U.S. We see in Leviticus 25:39, if a countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to you that he sells himself to you, you shall not subject him to a slave service. This is how people became servants. They were poor. This is a poor culture. They couldn't put food on the table. They're desperate. They're like, what am I going to do? They would go to somebody that was wealthier and say, I'll serve you 6 years. And that way they would get food and board, you know, shelter. And they wouldn't, you know, they could survive. And it was worth the 6 years. Today, think of somebody joining the Navy for 4 years. You can't get out, you know, once you join. It's very similar. It's really no different. I know a kid that joined the Air Force, and he's doing 4 years so that they will pay for his education. Okay, I kind of wish he hadn't done that. I think he could have paid for it other ways. But, I mean, you understand that's basically the same thing. It's, you know, in exchange for getting your bills paid, you offer. And he, you know, he's in there now, so there's nothing anyone can do about it. He's their slave. They own him. He's their servant. So the amazing thing, though, in Hebrew culture, so, you know, critics of the Bible be like, oh, slavery, whoa, and connecting it with slavery the way it was in the kind of antebellum South, when in fact it was nothing like that. Well, you can see right here. What kind of, you know, this is totally different when you have to let all your servants leave after 6 years. If he was single when he became your servant, he leaves as a single. But if he was married before he became a servant, then his wife has to be freed with him. So maybe a husband and wife both offer themselves and live on an estate, a farm, you know, as workers there, then you have to let both of them go. If his master gave him a wife while he was a servant and they had sons or daughters, then only the man will be free in the seventh year, but his wife and children would still belong to the master. Whoa. Oh my God, wait a minute. Savage. It sounds like the man gets to go free, not the woman. This rule doesn't apply to the women. Not true. None of this is true at all. The reason she's not being let loose is she has a different term of service. She hasn't finished her promised 6 years yet. So, he says, the servant may declare, I love my master, I love my wife, my children, I don't want to go free. And then if he does this, his master can present him before God. His master must take him to the door of the doorpost and publicly pierce his ear with an awl. It's believed that they also would, like, you'd get an ear piercing and then they would put a ring in there too. That was the ring that marked you as a bond servant. Now you are a voluntary servant for life at that point. There is really no reason to think that this is gender specific. He happens to be talking about a dude with a wife, but it applies equally if it's a wife with a husband. you know, case law. If this happens, do that. And it doesn't mean you're saying, and that's the only thing that happens. It's just like, here's an example of how this would work. The example he uses is of a guy. But we can demonstrate. Deuteronomy 15:12. If a fellow Hebrew sells himself or herself to be your servant and serves you for 6 years, and the seventh year you must set the servant free. It's not just the dudes. It's the tricks too. So, again, picking up when you're reading case law, it's different. You have to realize these situations that are described are not going to be universal. They're going to be very specific. And that you can't say then that that's the way that things always were. I mean, that right there, written by the same author, shows, and it was the same legal code, shows that it's male or female. He's basically saying in this, the guy could, you know, work somewhere else and wait for his wife to finish her term of service, then she could get out too. Or his alternative is he becomes a bond servant. And a lot of times people would do that. Probably, again, in this type of culture, particularly with the, as we'll see, the legal protections and guarantees given to servants, it really wasn't that much different than being an employee today. You know, you take a 40-year-old guy that's worked for the same company for 20 years. Does he have the freedom to leave and go somewhere else and get a job? Not really. I mean, at that point, it's going to be very difficult for that guy to get a job. And so you basically need to stay there. And, you know, so what? You're making a wage, and that's what you needed. These were often parts of a household that you often lived together in the same house. It wasn't this real servile, negative thing. When a man sells his daughter as a servant, she will not be freed at the end of 6 years as the men are. Okay, Paul Copin's a professor of philosophy and ethics at Atlantic University, has written an amazing book on case law in the Old Testament called Is God a Moral Monster? And it's written in reply to the kind of new atheists that have chosen this area as a place of attack. Very excellent book. You really, if you're interested in this whole field, you owe it to yourself, I think, to read through that book. He says this pericope, that's a section of scripture, it's an argument, pertains to a girl who is sold by her father, not for slavery, but for marriage. Nonetheless, she's designated a servant. But the point is that he's signed a marriage contract where money would be exchanged. The man would have to give money to the girl's family in order to get her as a bride. Should the terms of marriage not be fulfilled, it's a breach of contract. The purchaser has to let the girl be redeemed. She can be taken back. If the father gives back the money, he can have back his daughter. But she must not be sold. As it goes on, if she does not satisfy her owner, he must allow her to be bought back again by her family, but he is not allowed to sell her to foreigners since he's the one who broke the contract with her. It's a contract that he broke. You see, you can tell from the language at 8, the fact that he broke a contract. What contract did he break? The contract to marry her. It's clear that this was a contracted marriage that's in view here, not normal servanthood. We need to remember that case law begins with these specific examples that don't necessarily present a best case scenarios. When you read through case law, a lot of it's negative stuff. If two people fight, if a man punches another guy, if an ox gores a man, you know, if somebody falls off the roof and dies, so on. A lot of them are negative situations that are being imagined. And what we're realizing is that case law in the Old Testament is dealing with a real society, an ancient culture of people. This scenario here, why would a father sell his daughter? It's out of economic desperation. They're losing it. They're on the verge of starvation. He finds a man willing to marry her, a man of means that will take care of her. He sells the rights to marriage, bride price. It's the ancient way. I mean, this is pretty much the way it was everywhere up until modern times. And yet, the intent of the legal code here is actually to protect women that are being sold into a marriage like this. It's to protect them from getting screwed over. Even if the conditions are less than ideal, the goal is to protect women in unfortunate circumstances. One of the things we'll see with this whole case law business, it's not ideal. Like maybe the Ten Commandments was more idealized ethics. Here with case law, we're dealing with reality and a fallen ancient culture. Israel's laws provided a safety net for its very poorest people. Voluntary selling was a matter of survival in harsh financial circumstances. Well, and verse 9 says, if the servant's owner arranges for her to marry his son, he may no longer treat her as a servant, but as a daughter. If a man who has married servant wife takes another wife for himself, he must not neglect the rights of the first wife to food, clothing, and sexual intimacy. Okay, now we're adding polygamy to slavery. Except that, and I thought Copen's argument was pretty good here. Definitely in this translation, which is NLT, these words, who has married a servant wife, are not there in the original. That's been supplied by the translators. They thought it was implied. Neither are these words there, that the rights of his first wife. It never really says that he ever married the first woman. This whole translation sucks. Here's what it should say. If he marries another woman instead of the one he contracted for, he must not deprive the first one of her food, clothing, and is it marital rights, or is Copan correct when he says, oh, nah, should be translated shelter? It would certainly make a lot more sense, food, clothing, and shelter. So he's contracted for this wife. He realizes, I don't want to marry her. I want to marry someone else. Then he has to take care of her and give her food, shelter, and clothing. And they cannot just throw her out on the street or something like that. He's obligated to her, even if he never married her. Copeland says, we can more confidently conclude that the quarters or shelter are in view here, not conjugal rights. So the servant, and he gives a whole, you know, two-page explanation of the Hebrew here that I thought was pretty good. So the servant girl should be guaranteed the basic necessities, food, clothing, and lodging or shelter. That's what it's really saying. So there's three issues involved in these 10 verses we've read so far. The first is, if the man rejects the servant woman as a wife, she is to be given her freedom or redeemed, bought back by her family. So this is a girl who is both servant and intended to be a wife. Unlike everyone else in the ancient world, if you owned a servant, if you owned a slave, you could have sex with that slave anytime you want. And all your friends could too. It's whatever you want to do. They had no rights. Not true in Israel. If you wanted to have sex with your servant, you have to marry her. You have to pay her family the price. As she's a full-blown, you know, person, just like anyone else. If his son wants to marry her, she's to be taken in as a family member and treated like a daughter. And if the man marries a different woman, the servant woman is to receive food, clothing, and lodging. Is it referring to polygamy? Not necessarily. It doesn't state that it's polygamy. But even if it is, they did have polygamy. It is permitted. It's another one of those things where we'll see where there's concessions given to the realities of the day. And there's a difference between what God would have liked to have seen and what he actually is able to get from people. And so in case law, it makes provision for these compromises. Finally, in verse 11, if he fails in any of these three obligations, she can leave as a free woman without making any payment. So when, you know, we can read this, and the way that you have to read it is in comparison with the rest of the ancient Near Eastern practice. And there is where all of a sudden this set of case law just stands out in a spectacular way. You realize what we're dealing with here is indentured servitude of people with full rights of humans, just like anyone else, except they're obligated to serve for 6 years. Other than that, they're just like any other person and cannot be mistreated. If a master kills a servant, it's murder. They're sentenced to death. The master's sentenced to death. That's totally different. In the ancient Near East, you can kill your slaves whenever you want. That's up to you whether you kill them, whether you beat them, whether you rape them. The slave has no rights whatsoever, and you can see yourself. This code is setting out and saying, no, they do have rights, and you cannot transgress their humanity in that way. In fact, let's just list a series of points here to remember when you're reading case law. I'm not going to read through all three chapters because it's, you know, it's very detailed, but we'll talk about a number of the passages in here. Here's a couple of examples of case law from 21. If someone's ox injures a neighbor's ox and the injured ox dies, then the two owners must sell the live ox and divide the price equally between them. They can also divide the dead animal. You know, the dead animal was valuable. That was a lot of meat. In this type of culture where people were barely making, in the agrarian culture. And so, yeah, they're just imagining a situation. Then they say, but if the ox had a reputation for goring, and yet its owner failed to keep it under control, he must pay full compensation, a live ox for the dead one. But he can keep the dead ox. A lot of this is actually really pretty funny. But I mean, so, okay, you're a judge in a court, and you're basically reading this, and that basically shows you how you should think about things like this. My livestock injured your livestock. You know, how do we arbitrate something like this? This basically shows you what you need to know. Let's look at another example. A newly married man must not be drafted into the army or be given any other official responsibilities. He must be free to spend 1 year at home bringing happiness to the wife he has married. That's pretty humane. We don't have any law like that. In this day, if you happen to get married and there's a draft, you're taken. I don't care anything about that. Verse 6, it's wrong to take a set of millstones, or even just the upper millstone, as security for a loan, for the owner uses it to make a living. See, and so in a lot of these, there in verse 5, you know, this wife just got married, and he should be with her for a year to bring her happiness. And the millstone, the guy makes his living from that. No, you can't take that as security. Both stones, or even just the top stone, because how are you going to grind with one stone? You need both of those stones in order to make your living, so find something else to take as security, not that. And it's putting limits on the powers of the rich over the poor. A lot of these laws are set up to defend and protect poor and weak people. Okay. Here's my principles that you can jot these down. These will come in very handy. First of all, the case laws of Moses are not eternal. They're not unchanging. Within the code itself, it changes from age to age. They're not absolute. These are not moral absolutes. They are guidelines for the court to use. Take, for example, Numbers 27. You have the story of the daughters of Zelophehad. They come before Moses, two daughters. They say, our father died out in the wilderness during the 40 years, and he wasn't a part of the Korah, Dathan, and Abiram crew or anything like that. He just died for his own sins. But he didn't have any son. And now we're going into the land, and our family isn't being apportioned any land because the rules are that it's the tradition of primogeniture, you know, where it's the oldest son inherits the land. They have no son. They have no male heir. And you're like, now we're not going to get any property. And our father's like, family's going to come to an end as far as property owners. We think this is unfair. We think we should get a piece of land too. Moses is like, well, I'm going to ask God about this. He goes into the tent of meeting and says, what about this, Lord? And the Lord's like, yeah, they've got a just plea. And he comes out with a new list of rules. If they should get land, give them a piece of land, and if a guy dies without a male heir, you do this. And if you give it to his women folk, and if they're not there, then you give it to his brother's family. And if his brother isn't around, then you give it to his father's brother, and so on and so forth. It's got all of these if things laid out. And so they basically changed the code based on these women coming forward and saying, how about it? And so there was that changeability. The code itself, the Mosaic code, makes it clear that it's not intended for permanent use. It's given to a nation of people, most of whom were unregenerate. The majority of these people didn't know God in a personal way. They were not following God. That becomes clear as their history unfolds. And so these laws are not given to people that are like all in for God at all. They're given to people who, you know, hate even being bothered by it, and who aren't willing to go beyond a certain point. There's an unwillingness here to go beyond a certain point in following God's direction. And so what we find as a result is compromise. It's the difference between what God wants, really, and what he's able to get. And you see this compromise in one area after the other in the case law in the Old Testament. You didn't really see it in the Ten Commandments. You don't see it in the principalized law. But you do see it in case law. Jesus declared that this was the case when he came in Matthew 19. And he says, because of the hardness of your heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. There's provision for divorce in the Mosaic law. Most of it's to protect women from being discarded lightly. They have to be given a certificate of divorce. They have rights within that. They can't be arbitrarily divorced. And he says, Moses permitted it because of the hardness of your hearts. But from the beginning, it was not this way. As a matter of fact, he cites the second chapter of Genesis, which says the two shall become one. That was the intent. And he says, Moses provided divorce because of the hardness of your heart. People just weren't willing to follow faithfully. And so there had to be a provision made, a compromise with the sinfulness of people. Malachi 2 says God hates divorce. God says through Malachi, I hate divorce. It wasn't that divorce is okay. It was that because of the hardness of your heart and because of your unwillingness to follow God, he has to make provisions for stuff like this. And a lot of things would fit that same category. We remember it's a national constitution of an actual nation. It's not just a religious text, a spiritual text. This is actual courtroom material that we're reading. He wants us to make a nation that's very different from the other nations. And yet, he has to work with what he has, which are unregenerate people that are not spiritually filled and are going to be weak. And going to be unwilling to a significant extent. A lot of the case law that we're reading is to protect the weak. We see, for example, here in Exodus 22. You must not exploit a widow or an orphan. See, widows had lost their man and they were vulnerable. Women were vulnerable in the ancient world. They couldn't just go out and get a job at a company. Like you can today. They wanted manual laborers in a farm or something like that. It was hard for women to get a job, especially if they had kids. The orphan, they were vulnerable. They had no father to make their way. There were violent people all around that could take advantage of women and orphans. God says, if you exploit them in any way and they cry out to me, I'll certainly hear their cry and my anger will blaze against you. He's like, I'll kill you. And then your wife can be a widow and your kids can be orphans. How about that? If you think it's okay to exploit them, then you won't mind it when everyone's exploiting your widow and orphans after you're dead. So it's very strong language. In Israel, most of the families were landowners. It's pretty clear. It's a small landowner culture. They had a tribal kinship type society that was socially decentralized. And this held all the way up until Solomon, 400 years later. At the time of the United Monarchy, he started to consolidate and a lot of people were losing their properties because of the taxes and other economic conditions. The Canaanites, all the surrounding nations, totally different. There they had a feudalistic type system with a king and a powerful elite at the top. The peasants were like serfs at the bottom. The kings owned all the land in these countries. It's explicitly taught. The people there get to rent it from the king. They can rent a place. It's kind of like feudal Europe where the serfs don't own anything, and they're not free to go anywhere either. They're on a fiefdom, an earldom or whatever it is in Europe, and they were basically slaves there. They had to work that land, give a huge portion into the noble that owned it, and they were not free to go to any other noble's place. That's basically the Canaanite system. And here you have Israel coming in, radically different. And this small landholding scenario is what is being taught in scores of these case laws. We always have to read case law in the context of the ancient Near East. This is where they lived. The Jews would sit there and look right over and here were nations doing it completely different than them. And so the temptation was strong. And they often succumbed to the temptation to run things the way the Canaanites did. They were always tempted to follow them. And God is trying to push them to be different up to a point. But he's probably realizing there's a limit to how far it can push these guys. They just won't listen after a certain point. And so that's when the compromise comes in. So consider various laws that come up. The lex talionis, the law of retaliation. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. You know, it's basically you gouged out my eye, come here, I'm going to gouge out your eye. You knocked out my tooth, I'm going to knock out your tooth. In practice, that is not what happened. In practice, what happened was, okay, come here, we're going to gouge out your eye. And I'm like, whoa. Oh, dude, it was an accident. Isn't there any other arrangement we can make? Yeah, you owe me $10,000 for my eye I lost. Dude, I don't have that much. That's too much. Okay, come here. Oh, wait. And so these were the negotiations that went on in the court. It's like, oh, you don't think losing an eye is worth that much money? Then come here and let's pop your eye and see how you feel about it then. And so people often negotiate a little more reasonably at that point. The purpose of the eye for an eye law is not to increase the penalty in liability cases, but to limit it. In the ancient Near East, this is how it worked. Oh, you caused me to lose my hand, I'm going to kill your family for that. And this is how these blood feuds would get going. And it's like, you mess with me, I'm going to mess with you 10 times over. The lex talionis is saying, no, it has to match. And they're telling the judges, the courts, to run it that way. Don't let somebody go hog wild on someone else just because they were injured by that person in some way. Slavery, as we already saw, utterly different. No for slavery. We saw that kidnapping people for slavery was a capital crime in Israel. We saw how they became slaves was selling themselves voluntarily into a limited period of servitude, and then they had to be set free. We look all around the ancient world. Where's another example of this? There's nothing like that anywhere except in Israel. Now think about this. So here we have something. So far, this couldn't be further from the description dished out by people like Dawkins, who say this is inhuman thinking here. This is barbaric. Not really at all. What everyone else was doing was barbaric. We read the description here and we see the legal rights of servants and also that they only serve for a finite period. Property crimes. Amazingly mild treatment for this in the case law of the Old Testament. In Babylonian law, in Assyrian law, in Egyptian law, mutilation, cutting off, if someone was caught stealing, especially if it was from a noble person, it was from the gentry, cut off their hand. That was a common penalty in the law of Moses. I agree with Copin's analysis that in the laws of Moses, not a single case of mutilation is ever prescribed, including the case of the lady that seizes the genitals. I'm just going to let you read that part in him. That was got so raw, I just decided I couldn't get into it. But I think he's right. I think he's got a good explanation. It's not cutting off of the hand. There is no cutting off of anything, anywhere in the law of Moses. Whereas you had cutting off of the hands, the feet, the tongue, and the ear were very common prescriptions in the legal codes of the nations around them. Paying a price for a bribe, which we just saw a reference to. Well, is this dehumanizing women? Is this treating women like they were donkeys or something like that? You buy a donkey or you can buy a bride. Actually, this was a way that an ancient man could show that he was serious about his intentions regarding a lady that to marry her. It also served as kind of a security for the wife in case of his death. She would go back to her family and they would have this money, which was substantial. And by all accounts, often amounted to a couple years' wage that were paid for these bride prices. Expensive to get a wife. That money, though, then, was there as a protection. It meant that the man had a big investment in getting this marriage to work. It brought the two families together around this central goal of forming a new family. And there were negotiations and the exchange, which favored the female's family. Again, this is a protection to women. Think about the system in India to this day where it's the woman's family that has to pay the man to take her. That's really not that good. That's not that good for women. And it makes it's easy for parents to feel like having daughters is just a liability. You know, they don't bring any income in and you got to pay to get rid of them. And it results in a negative attitude toward women. Here, the father of daughters is going to receive major monies into the family because of his daughters. These laws all put together are there to protect women. That's what they're for. The thought of putting a woman into an unwanted marriage. Every indication is that was rare. And of course, an unloving pair of parents could probably do that. But and the examples we have, they always in the Old Testament, they always talk about the parents going and asking the daughter, what do you think about this? And she gets to decide whether she wants to marry the guy. Polygamy. It existed in the Old Testament as it did everywhere else in the ancient world. But it is never endorsed. It is never enjoined. And as Jesus pointed out, it was never really what God intended. Instead, we find that throughout the Old Testament, the stories of people with polygamous marriages come to nothing but trouble because of that. You know, you think of Isaac and his... Jacob and his two wives, Leah and Rachel, loved one more than the other. And that's what set up all the problems in his family. And it goes right on down the same way. Polygamy always leads to negative things. And then the supreme examples with David. And finally, the worst of all, Solomon. And this is what ruined his life, was his polygamy. still, at times, with the frequency of war, which was an annual event in the ancient world, war was a way of life. There were all these raiding powers that would continually be invading your country and trying to capture slaves and booty. It's just easier to go kill people and take their stuff than it was to get your own stuff. And so there was a lot of male death in that setting. A lot of guys died in war. There were more women than men. It was probably partly a concession, again, to economic realities, which is that single women were not in a good situation. They needed to have a family they could be in. Lending money. When you borrowed money, when the Israelite went to borrow money, it wasn't to start a corner drugstore or something, an investment in a business. It was because they were starving. It's because they couldn't pay their bills. And they would go borrow money to keep from losing their land. In ancient Israel, you could not charge them any interest, and they're enjoined. You need to lend them freely. And then, every 49 years, all debts are canceled. Everybody's debt, no matter what it is. If they couldn't pay on their loan, and they had to forfeit their farm to you, then at the Jubilee year, it goes back. And that's called the Jubilee Law. And the family gets their farm back, even though they didn't pay for the loan they got. it's like extremely lenient on the poor, on the people that would borrow. But if you loan to an outsider, a foreigner who's living in your midst, the reason foreigners would live in your midst was to do business. That loan was probably a commercial loan for use in business, and therefore you could charge interest in that case, but not if it was for the poor. Let's take a couple of minutes just on cleanliness and kosher laws, which are another category, okay? These laws are the laws along the lines of, you know, you shouldn't eat this, shouldn't eat that, don't mix together, you know, wool and linen and a fabric. Don't plant your field in beans and corn, you know, either one or the other. And there's all these different things like that. Don't touch dead bodies. There's a whole bunch of them. First thing you need to understand, I'm not going to go through a detailed coverage of cleanliness laws, but to be unclean is not the same as to be in sin. It's a symbolic, it's a ritual designation that means you're not allowed to come into the tabernacle until you get this resolved. It's basically, it's a negative. It's saying there's something negative about it, but not that you're guilty of wrongdoing. Usually most of these are teaching something. And there's themes that are being taught through the cleanliness and the diet laws. All the different anti-mixing laws, where you shouldn't mix things together, is teaching the importance of the concept of separation, which is related to the Hebrew concept of holiness, to be separate and different and not just mixed in like everything else. And these themes are kind of taught through these mixing rules they had. Human reproduction creates uncleanliness at multiple points. Nocturnal emission for men, menstruation for women, and so on. Having sex itself in certain conditions, during certain festivals, you're supposed to abstain for a few days, and if you don't, you're unclean. It's not saying that sex is bad. It's not saying that reproduction is bad, but reproduction is linked to, it's in reproduction that the sin nature is passed down. The inheritance of the sin nature is why God puts these certain marks on reproduction, just to remind people there's a problem, ongoing problem with the human race, and it's being passed down through reproduction. To distinguish between this covenant people, the Hebrews, and other peoples, a lot of the laws are just nothing but that. You think of circumcision as that way. Through circumcision, a Hebrew male was reminded of who he is, even at his most intimate moments. You know, if he was going to go and access a prostitute or something, a woman from another culture, there'd be something that would be a pretty harsh reminder there. Some of the dietary laws are this way. Some of the dress and the hair laws are this way, with the trimming of the beard. It had the effect of making Jews look different than other people. And that was basically a constant reminder, you are different than them. You are in a covenant with God. And so that was what they were teaching through those laws. So there's a real brief survey of case laws and cleanliness and kosher laws. What are we to get from this today? First of all, I think we need to know basic answers to the attacks launched on this, because I really feel like if you study what's being said here and you study in the context of the ancient Near East, what we have is a remarkably liberal code stressing equality of all people, both genders, all races. It's explicit that the foreigner and the people of other peoples that are in your midst have to be treated by the same standard as everyone else. You cannot mistreat them. And it's just amazing in its setting in the ancient world. No, it doesn't match up to modern Western culture. Because, for one thing, our culture has been significantly impacted by the much more advanced picture given in the New Testament. It's Christianity that has influenced Western ethical thinking. And that's a couple thousand years further down the pike, and it's a higher standard. Secondly, we shouldn't assume that any of these laws apply today. They don't. We're not under this covenant, and while the moral laws, we argued, apply in the sense that they reflect the character of God, so there's still a goal that we should seek for, these don't even fit that. These don't apply in any way, because it was rules for running a culture that isn't around anymore, for running a society. By the way, on point one, needing to know the basic answers, you owe it to yourself, I think, to read a good book on this. We used to recommend John Wenham's excellent book, The Goodness of God, but frankly, Paul Copan has blown him away. This book is double, triple what Wenham's book is. You owe it to yourself to read that book. I think it was awesome, very detailed, very satisfying. Today, these laws don't apply. We're not under a theocracy, a culture led by God anymore. We are sojourners in other people's countries, you know, with the king. And it says, respect the king, respect the government, whatever it happens to be in the New Testament. In fact, as Christians, we're no longer a nation at all. We're never given that charge that we're supposed to form a physical nation on earth. It's not our business. Also, we as Christians are now indwelt personally. We have the Spirit of God living within us. That puts us on a level far above what any of these guys were. I mean, they did not have that level of spiritual strength that we get when we come into relationship with God. And so they're just not on the same level as us. Of course, we can look at these laws and still today distill moral content, moral principles from them. You know, like we saw kind of the sympathetic treatment of weak and vulnerable people in society and not taking advantage of them. And so those principles are still good, and we can distill that, but it's indirect. It's not that we would follow the actual case law or consider that binding, but we would, the concept underlying it is good. Even in the Old Testament itself, it was always explicit that this is only temporary, that this is going to all be done away with. Take, for example, in the book of Jeremiah. Behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Not like the covenant which I made with their fathers in the day I took them by the hand and bring them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant which they broke, although I was like a husband to them, declares the Lord. I'm not going to make another one of those. So it's not going to be like the one with Moses, the one we're reading and studying. Different than that. He says, and this is the covenant I'll make in the house after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them, and on their heart I will write it, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. The new covenant. That's the covenant we're under. To have the laws of God in your heart is what happens when the Holy Spirit enters your life. When we read Jesus saying, behold, I knock at the door, and if anyone opens the door, I will come into him and dine with him and he with me. I was talking about a personal transaction called receiving Christ, where you open the door to your heart and say, God, come into my life. And then the Spirit of God comes in. You don't need a legal code. You don't need to say, let's see. Number 53 seems to speak to this here. You know, we don't relate to God that way. We don't relate through a legal code, but through a spiritual relationship where, just like you would, you know, with your husband or your wife, you know, you don't have to go be like, okay, let's see. I can tell she's upset at me. I'm going to look up in the contract here. That's bizarre. That's way below what you would expect in a relationship with somebody. You seem like you're a little unhappy. I mean, is it because of this? You know, yeah. And you can tell. And so you sense one another dynamically. And this is exactly where we're at with God, is that we know when we're out of his will and we sense it doesn't feel right and I want to get back in his will. And so we're under that new covenant, which is really pretty awesome. You got to think about, if you've never invited the Spirit of God into your life, what do you think about doing that tonight? This would be a great time to do something like that. There's no preconditions. No matter what your life has been like, you know, Jesus died to forgive sin. And so no matter what we are, when we come to him, you think of the thief on the cross dying next to Jesus. He said, remember me when you come into your kingdom. That's all he said. And Jesus is like, I tell you the truth, you're going to be with me today in paradise. That's so it's the intent of the heart to establish that relationship with God. All right, well, that's enough for one night on case law.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.